My boyfriend was sent to South Africa, she said. It was a nice, easy way to start the conversation. I received two letters from him after his deployment began. Then nothing. His family heard nothing, too. It was only through a friend in the medical office that I heard he'd actually been sent back to the Reich, that he is currently in hospital right here in Berlin. She swallowed hard, then outlined what she'd done, careful not to mention that Kurt had also been involved. His CO would be furious, at the very least. Kurt would probably find himself attached to a punishment battalion and sent to clear a minefield or chase insurgents in Russia, the insurgents who'd been defeated, according to the news, several times over. The more she looked at the news with a cynical eye, the more she saw the discrepancies. If Russia was safe, why were so many soldiers dying there? They lied to us, she said. Conrad was nothing special, Leopold said. He'd never liked Conrad. The SS was rarely popular outside Germany East. Why would anyone bother to cover up his wounds? They wouldn't, Gudrun said, and outlined what she'd deduced. They must be lying about more than just one wounded soldier. How many others have died or been wounded in South Africa?
The news says that only a few hundred soldiers have been killed or wounded on deployment, Hilda said. She sounded shaken. My boyfriend, could he have been killed or wounded too?
Gudrun winced. Hilda's boyfriend was a tanker who'd been deployed to South Africa a month after Conrad. Martin had never seemed a decent guy to her, but Hilda had clearly liked him, even loved him.
I don't know, she said. Has he been writing to you?
He sends letters, but they're always delayed, Hilda said. I only get them 2 or 3 weeks after they're posted.
They're censored, Sven said. Too late, Gudrun remembered that Sven's older brother was a soldier, too. It was rare to find a German family who didn't have at least one member in the military. The REMFs always insist on reading letters before they're forwarded to their recipients. Hilda colored.
But he wrote,
Gudrun could guess.
I don't think they really care about endearments, she said.
She had a feeling that Martin had written something a little more passionate than Conrad ever had, but the censors probably wouldn't care. It wasn't as if he was sending racy postcards of himself back to his girlfriend. However, they probably do black out anything to do with the war itself. Leopold frowned.
Do you have any idea how dangerous this conversation is?
Yes, Gudrun said flatly. Yes, I do. She did offer to allow us to leave, Hilda pointed out.
Gudrun shot her a grateful look.
We're being lied to, she said bluntly, and many of us have relatives who may already be dead or wounded, and we don't know.
This could be just an absurd coincidence, Leopold said after a moment. Conrad, his face twisted for a moment, might have been caught up in a covert operation of some kind.
This isn't a story from one of those damned Otto Skorzeny books, Sven snapped. Conrad wasn't a superhuman commando, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound.
Gudrun hid a smile. She'd been forced to read the Otto Skorzeny books herself at school. Otto Skorzeny, who apparently had been a real person, had pulled off hundreds of death-defying stunts that had reshaped the face of the world. Skorzeny had been pitted against a multitude of villains. Evil Jewish bankers, evil American capitalists, evil Russian communists, evil British monarchists, and emerged triumphant every time. The books had practically drooled over how Skorzeny proved that National Socialism was the way forward. None could stand against Skorzeny, they'd claimed, because he was a true follower of Adolf Hitler. And how many of those stories, Gudrun asked herself, were made up of whole cloth. Hilda held up a hand.
If there's one, as Gudrun said, there will be others, she said. And Martin could be among the dead.
Let's assume that's true, Leopold said. What do we do about it?
What can we do? Isla Grosser asked. It isn't as if we have any real power.
The first thing we do is try and find out how widespread this is, Gudrun said.
She'd need more than a single wounded SS trooper to convince people that something was very badly wrong. We all know people who are serving in South Africa. I want you all to ask questions, to find out when those people last wrote to their families, to find out when they last had leave from the front. We will all ask those questions.
Martin's family won't talk to me, Hilda said. They don't think I'd make a good housewife.
Leopold snickered.
Tell them you're pregnant.
Hilda glared at him.
I've bled 3 times since he left, she snarled. I don't have any way to convince them I'm pregnant.
Leopold turned red and started to sputter. Gudrun winked at Hilda. Sex education in the Reich was very limited, but they'd all been taught how their bodies worked and how to recognize a pregnancy. She'd always found it amusing how men turned deaf whenever the subject of female issues cropped up, although she was privately sure that men talked about them in private. Why not? She and her girlfriends often poked fun at male foibles.
You can just tell them that you're worried about him, she said. I think they'd appreciate that, you know.
I doubt it, Hilda said.
She looked downcast for a long moment.
They were trying to set him up with some brainless bitch who came top of the class in basic housewifery.
My mother is hardly brainless, Gudrun said, and I don't think anyone else has a brainless mother either.
That's not very helpful, Hilda said.
Gudrun shrugged. Are we all agreed on our first step?
Yeah, Sven said. But tell me, Gudrun, what are we going to do if we discover there are more soldiers who've lost contact with their families?
Then we decide what to do, Gudrun said.
She had half a plan already, but she needed them to understand what was going on before she could push them to commit to anything more than private discussions.
You can all think about it while we're gathering data, and then we can decide what to do.
Escape to America, Horst said quietly. My brother says he isn't planning to come back after his period in America comes to an end.
Gudrun sucked in her breath. She'd applied for the chance to become an exchange student, but she wasn't particularly hopeful. Even if she won one of the coveted slots, her parents would probably refuse to allow her to leave the country. But if she was allowed to leave, would she return? There was no shortage of whispered stories about students who tasted life in America, home of blue jeans, country music, and freedom, and refused to come back to Germany.
I don't know, she said.
Without one of the slots, it was unlikely she could get to Vichy, France, let alone Britain. She wouldn't have a travel permit, for one thing, and an unaccompanied teenage girl would raise eyebrows.
We are supposed to be the smartest people in Germany. I'm sure we can figure something out.
There were stories of student protests in America, Isla said.
Those students weren't at risk of being gunned down like rampaging Gastarbeiters, Horst snapped. If we do anything with this information, we run a terrible risk.
Yes, we do, Gudrun said.
She took a breath.
Conrad is an SS trooper, I know. Some of you detested him for wearing the Sigrunen lightning bolts. But he is a brave and decent man, and he has been betrayed by the men he serves. A dead war hero is meant to be given a hero's funeral. A wounded war hero is meant to lack for nothing. And yet, what does he have? A hospital bed in a crowded ward, and no hope of recovery, while his family thinks he's still in South Africa. What will they tell his family when he is due to return from the war?
She took a breath, looking from face to face. None of them had really known what they were getting into. Not really. They certainly hadn't realized what she intended to tell them.
I am not going to sit on my backside and do nothing, she concluded. We are going to find out the truth, and then we are going to work out what to do with it. It is our duty to our country. That is what we are going to do.
Chapter 7. Schulze Residence, SS Safe House, Berlin. 20 July, 1985.
Gudrun, Liana Schulze called as she opened the door. Have you heard anything from my brother?
Gudrun felt a stab of guilt as she looked at the younger girl. Liana was 16, on the verge of adulthood. Hell, she could marry with her parents' permission, if she didn't want to finish her final year of schooling. And she'd always looked up to Gudrun, chatting happily to her about nothing in particular. Gudrun had always thought she'd make a good sister-in-law. But she didn't dare tell the younger girl the truth. She'd speak to her father, and he'd report Gudrun to the authorities.
"I haven't heard anything from your brother," she said.
It was true enough.
"I actually came to speak to your father."
Liana's face fell. Gudrun understood. She was the only child left in the house, now that Conrad had gone to war. She'd have no one to talk to, merely chores to perform for her mother. And she had to have known, at some deep level, that Gudrun hadn't come to talk to her. Gudrun was 18 and a university student to boot. Socially, they had very little in common. They'd hardly spend time together when Conrad wasn't around.
"I understand," she said. "Are you..."
Pregnant? Gudrun thought. She hadn't gone all the way with Conrad. And it would have been obvious that I was pregnant 4 months ago if I was pregnant.
"No,
but I do need to speak to him," she said.
"Is he in his study?"
"I think so," Liana said. She held the door open long enough for Gudrun to step inside, and then closed it before leading the way through the living room and up to the door of Volker Schulze's study. It was firmly shut, perhaps locked. Liana tapped on the door and waited for her father to invite her in before opening the door. Gudrun stepped past her and into the study.
"Gudrun," Volker Schulze said.
He lifted an eyebrow as he turned to face her.
"What brings you to my house?"
Gudrun hesitated, bracing herself. Volker Schulze had always made her a little nervous, even though she had the feeling that her father was meant to make Conrad nervous. He looked like an older version of his son, his face marred by scars from a long career in the SS before he'd retired and found work as a factory foreman. His study was covered with mementos of his career, from a spiked helmet he'd salvaged from somewhere to a pistol he claimed to have taken from a British commando team in North Africa. A large chart hung on the far wall, showing the spread of the Reich. "And just how much of that chart," Gudrun asked herself, "is a lie?" She pushed the question to one side.
"Since we last spoke, I haven't heard anything from Conrad," she said simply. "I was wondering if you'd heard anything from him yourself."
Volker Schulze looked pensive.
"I haven't heard anything, no," he said.
Gudrun trusted he wouldn't have kept anything from her if he had heard something.
"Do you have reason to worry?"
"I miss him," Gudrun said.
"Young men have always gone to war,"
Volker Schulze said, as reassuringly as he could.
"I believe that young women like you have always waited for their heroes to come home."
Gudrun winced before she could catch herself. One thing that had been hammered into her head at school was the importance of remaining faithful. A girl who dumped a boy while he was on deployment could expect to be a social pariah, even if the boy had been abusive and beaten her while they were together. Even if there had been someone else, she knew, it would have been cruel to dump Conrad while he was away. She would have waited for him to come home before telling him the bad news.
"But I've heard nothing," she said plaintively.
Perhaps it would cover her lapse.
"Where is he?"
"On deployment," Volker Schulze said.
He stood and patted her shoulder awkwardly.
"I was often out of touch for months at a time, Gudrun. Conrad may well be in the same position."
He paused.
"Are you..."
"No,"
Gudrun said firmly. She groaned inwardly, resisting the urge to rub his nose in how she knew she wasn't expecting a baby.
"I'm not pregnant."
"That's good," Volker Schulze said. "Gudrun, I understand how you feel, but Conrad isn't choosing not to write to you. I believe he will contact you as soon as he can. He does love you, and we, his parents, approve of you."
Gudrun felt another stab of bitter guilt.
Hilda wasn't atypical. Parents, particularly those who had lived through the deprivation of the war, wanted their sons to marry good housewives, women who could cook, clean, and bear their grandchildren. They didn't want academics, career women, or even the handful of girls who'd made a career in the military. They assumed, perhaps correctly, that such women would never let their husbands boss them around in public. Conrad's parents could easily have told him that they would never approve his relationship with Gudrun, and the hell of it was that they might have had a point. Instead, they'd welcomed her into their house.
"I thank you," she said, lowering her gaze.
"Have you heard anything else from the front?"
Volker Schulze gave her a sharp look.
"What do you mean?"
"The news is always bland," Gudrun said carefully. "I was wondering if you'd heard something a little more detailed."
"There are endless skirmishes with the insurgents," Volker Schulze said.
It wasn't much more than she could have deduced from the news broadcasts, reading between the lines.
"It may take longer than we had thought to defeat the niggers."
Gudrun blinked.
"The news said it would only be a short commitment."
Volker Schulze gave her a long, considering look.
"There are people in my office," he said, "who don't really understand how the factory actually works. Therefore, they make promises they cannot keep to people who are equally in the dark about what's actually happening, and rely on the managers on the ground to cover for their failings."
It took Gudrun a moment to realize what he was trying to tell her. If someone could be so out of touch in a small factory, and she had no trouble in believing it, how much more out of touch were the people in the Reichstag, the men who ran the country? Had they started the war in South Africa because they believed, honestly believed, that victory would be no harder than baking a cake?
"I believe my daughter misses you," Volker Schulze said after a moment. "You are, of course, quite welcome to visit any time you like."
"Thank you, sir," Gudrun said.
It wasn't entirely proper, but there would be a chaperone in the house if necessary.
"And I'm sorry."
"For not being pregnant?" Volker Schulze asked dryly. "I respect the Reichsführer's feelings regarding the need to raise the next generation of German men, but I am enough of a traditionalist to believe that the happy couple should be married before they start producing children. A child should know his father."
Gudrun blushed furiously. No one would really care if she was a virgin or not on her wedding night, not when everyone would understand her giving herself to her boyfriend before he went off to the war. The only real question would be if she'd had a child, and, if she had, what benefits the child could claim. Conrad's baby could draw an SS pension, as well as state child support. Hell, if she claimed he'd been planning to marry her, and his family would likely back her up, she could claim his SS pension as well. But it was immaterial. She'd never let him take off her panties, let alone go inside her.
"I agree," she said, torn between an insane urge to giggle and a growing urge to just turn and run.
Talking to her mother about men had been quite bad enough.
"Please, would you let me know the moment you hear anything?"
"I'll call your house directly," Volker Schulze promised.
He escorted her to the door. There was no sign of his wife or daughter, and waved her through. Gudrun gave him an impulsive hug, then hurried down the steps and back onto the road that led home. She had several other people she wanted to talk to before night fell, before she was expected home to assist her mother with the cooking. And then, "His family doesn't know," she thought, as she walked past a handful of soldiers making their way to the barracks on the outskirts of the city. She'd been sure of it, but it never hurt to make sure. They would have told me something if they'd heard anything. She glanced at her watch, then turned the corner. A couple of boys she'd known from her first house lived there. She'd played with them as a little girl before they'd gone to school and emerged too stuck up to play with girls. They, too, had gone to the wars. No one would mind if she asked after them, surely. And one of them
had been in the same unit as Hilda's boyfriend. It would be interesting to hear what they had to say. Horst Albrecht knew, without false modesty, that he was a very smart young man. Everyone had told him so, right from the day he'd entered upper schooling in Germanica and impressed his tutors with his intelligence. Indeed, his family had been so proud of him that they'd entered him into the SS Academy 2 years before the normal application date. The SS, somewhat to Horst's surprise, had accepted him without question. It had taken him a while to see why his superiors might be interested in a spy who was barely old enough to shave. But, by the time he'd graduated from one of the covert programs, he'd come to see the value of an agent who was literally 18 years old. "The university is a breeding ground for ideas," his trainers had told him when he'd finally passed the course. Being a spy was far more than charging around like Otto Skorzeny, riding hot motorcycles and winning the hearts of beautiful women. "Some of those ideas would be very bad. Your task is to watch for those who spread bad ideas and report them." It hadn't been hard at first. Horst had entered the university with the 1984 class. He'd made friends, chatted happily to everyone, and was generally well-liked by his peers. The students didn't want to look beyond the surface, not when they were escaping a regimented existence for the first time in their lives. Horst had no trouble making friends and generally being popular. Hell, he'd even had a couple of girlfriends. He hadn't expected Gudrun to be a troublemaker. Even now, hours after he'd made his slow way to the SS safe house, it doubled as a boarding house for students from Germany East, supervised by a grim-faced matron who provided all the explanation other students needed for why they weren't invited to the safe house. He still couldn't quite believe it. Gudrun was intelligent, true, and strikingly pretty. He might have dated her himself if she hadn't been involved with an SS trooper. Her father was a policeman, her brother a soldier in the Berlin Guard. She hardly fitted the profile of a potential troublemaker. There were few petty little resentments in her life, save for being born female. And she could overcome most of those problems by being a good student, Horst thought as he opened the door into his apartment. A computer expert or rocket scientist would be worth her weight in gold if she truly hated the thought of becoming a housewife. And yet, she'd said quite clearly that her boyfriend had been quietly shipped home, his wounds covered up. Her concern and her anger was quite justified. The apartment wasn't big, although it was vastly superior to the military barracks or slave pens for the Untermenschen in Germanica. He dropped his bag on the bed, clicked the kettle on, and prepared a mug of coffee. He'd long since grown used to the idea of never touching a drop of alcohol, even on Victory Day. Who knew what would come out of his mouth when he was drunk? Once his drink was ready, he placed it on the bedside table and lay down to have a bit of a think. Technically, he should report Gudrun at once. She had doubts, and instead of burying them, she was trying to do something. Something that might easily turn out to be treacherous. Horst couldn't imagine what she had in mind. 8 students or 80? Armed rebellion was unlikely to succeed, and she had to know it. But it was his duty to report her to his superiors, and let them decide how to handle the matter. It might come to nothing, he knew, or it might become something truly serious. His superiors might decide to quietly vanish Gudrun and her fellows, shipping them off to Germany East, or merely dumping them into a slave camp. The girls, at least, would make good breeding stock. And yet, he, too, had his doubts. He'd liked Konrad Schulze the first time they'd met. It wasn't something he could show, not when it would risk his cover, but he'd liked the older man. In some ways, Conrad had reminded Horst of his brother, who hadn't actually vanished into America and never returned.
He'd been blonde, blue-eyed, and muscular, so muscular that Horst had wondered if he'd been used as the template for countless recruiting posters. Horst had even used his security codes to look up the young man's file and discovered, to his amusement, that Conrad was on the short list for promotion. Someone thought very highly of him. But they don't now, Horst thought savagely. They see him as an embarrassment. It was a bitter thought. Conrad had been no covert agent, no undercover operative, all too aware that even the merest hint of suspicion would mean instant death or permanent incarceration in a black prison. He'd certainly had no reason to believe he would simply be abandoned by his superiors if he were caught by the enemy. No, he'd worn his black uniform proudly. Conrad should have been given full honors if he'd been killed, or brought home on a pension if he'd been badly wounded. Instead, he didn't think Gudrun had lied, but it would be easy enough to check her story. The computers in the apartment, another reason not to let anyone who wasn't an SS operative enter the building, were linked directly to the Berlin network. He logged on, accessed the hospital records, and searched for Conrad's name. The computers were slow. They hadn't had university students fiddling with the coding to make them a little more efficient. But it didn't take him long to uncover records belonging to one Conrad Schulze. He'd been badly wounded. The file didn't go into details, suggesting that no one had told the hospital administrators very much, and wasn't expected to survive. They should have triaged him, he thought, genuinely shocked. It was an accepted fact of military life that badly wounded soldiers were often allowed to die so less wounded soldiers could be saved, yet it was clear, just from reading between the lines, that the medical staff had worked desperately to save him. And yet, the brain damage alone almost guaranteed that Conrad would never recover. The bastards could have given him a mercy killing and come up with a cover story. Instead, they seemed content to leave him on life support indefinitely. A hero. And they chose to leave him a vegetable. Horst kept his feelings under tight control as he logged out of the hospital network, then checked the SS personnel database. Conrad's file had been marked inactive, and it wasn't the only one. Cross-referencing the database showed Horst several hundred other troopers who seemed to be permanently in bureaucratic limbo, marked as neither dead nor alive. And if that was true of the SS, it was very likely true of the Army, too. She didn't lie, he thought numbly. And that means... what? He turned the computer off, finished his coffee, and lay back on his bed. He'd been raised to worship the SS, just like everyone else in Germany East. The SS was all that stood between the settlements and insurgents who would happily kill German men, rape German women, and eat German children. He'd grown up reading horror stories, all of which had happy endings when the SS rescued the women or avenged their deaths. Joining the SS hadn't been a hard decision at all. They'd been his heroes. And now they were being betrayed. Betrayed by their own leaders. Gudrun would run into trouble sooner or later. Horst had no doubt of it. She was intelligent, and she knew to guard her tongue around strangers. But she had no way of knowing how things worked in the world. Hell, she'd managed to invite an SS spy to her very first meeting. She couldn't get very far without help. And Horst, who knew his duty called for him to report her, was seriously considering offering her that help. It was a hard choice to make. If he were caught, his family would disown him. And it probably wouldn't be enough to save their lives. It would be easy to alert the SS, to have Gudrun and the rest of the students put under surveillance and put an end to the whole affair. But he didn't want to put an end to the whole affair. He wanted her to do... what? What would she do if she proved her point?
Perhaps I'll just wait and see if she has a plan, he told himself. And if she does, I can decide what to do about it.
Chapter 8. Wewelsburg Castle, Germany. 20 July, 1985. It was blasphemy to even consider it, but there were times when Reichsfuhrer SS Karl Holliston thought that Heinrich Himmler had been a very strange man. Karl understood the value of strength and the will to use it as much as any other SS officer, yet Himmler's obsession with the occult had undermined the last 5 years of his career, allowing him to be gently nudged aside by his former subordinates. Wewelsburg Castle itself was a grand monument to that obsession. Parts of the castle had been redesigned to look like something from the Grand Order of Teutonic Knights, while other parts were designed to serve as the SS's western center of operations. There was even a monument to the Holy Grail in the lower levels, perched in the center of a round table. And some of Himmler's other ideas might have caught on if he'd had longer, Karl thought. Shrines to the old gods, grand ceremonies of might and magic. He shook his head in rueful amusement. Rumors of virgin sacrifices and blood oaths had hovered around the castle for as long as the SS had occupied it, and, indeed, there were some very strange cults and secret societies rumored to exist within the SS itself. Karl had never seen anything to indicate that they even existed, but that proved nothing. The SS was a multitude of competing factions, and some of them were very secretive indeed. And yet, what need did they have of the old gods? All that was needed was the will to power. A strong will can overcome anything, Karl thought, remembering his training as a young officer. They'd been pushed to the limit, the weak falling by the wayside or dying in training. The survivors strong enough to keep going, whatever the world threw at them. It had been 20 years since Karl had seen active service, since he'd been promoted to a desk job, but he'd done his best to stay in shape. And the will to power is everything. His buzzer rang.
Herr Reichsführer, Obergruppenführer Felix Kortig is here, his secretary said. Shall I send him in?
Yes, please, Karl said.
Maria had been with him ever since he'd been promoted into high office, her status rising with his. If she had any interests outside the office, he'd never seen them. He could be rude to anyone else, but not her. And hold all calls until I've finished with him. He looked up as the door opened, revealing a blonde-haired man wearing a black uniform and carrying a pistol at his belt. Karl couldn't avoid a flicker of envy as Obergruppenführer Felix Kortig strode forward and snapped out a precise salute. Kortig might be an Obergruppenführer, but he was still jumping out of planes with the young bucks while Karl himself was stuck in an office playing political games with the civilians and the military.
Herr Reichsführer, Kortig said.
Heil Bormann!
Heil Bormann, Karl echoed.
You may speak freely and relax.
Kortig relaxed minimally.
Jawohl, Herr Reichsführer, he said. You wish to speak with me?
Yes, Karl said. He tapped the papers on his desk. I trust you have had an opportunity to study the proposals for Operation Headshot.
I have, Kortig said.
They're unworkable.
Karl blinked in surprise, despite himself. Very few people would tell the Reichsführer SS that one of his pet concepts was unworkable, which might explain why Himmler had been able to waste so many resources on his occult research. Sending teams of dedicated researchers to Tibet, even in the aftermath of the war, hadn't been too costly, but transporting ancient artifacts all the way back to Germany had proved a major strain. The rest of the Reich hadn't been too pleased at the prospect of a diplomatic incident with China, even if the Chinese had been fighting a civil war at the time. He pushed the thought aside angrily.
Unworkable?
Yes, Herr Reichsführer, Kortig said.
Karl bit down on his anger with an effort. Otto Skorzeny plotted to jump into London in 1950 and slaughter the British government, he said. Wouldn't that have been a more challenging operation? The operation was planned in the context of an outright invasion, Kortig pointed out smoothly.
I have seen those plans, Herr Reichsführer. Skorzeny intended to jump into Westminster, kill as many government ministers as he could find, and then escape into the streets of London. Given the lack of extraction plans, I suspect Skorzeny believed the whole operation to be a suicide mission. The best the commandos could reasonably hope for was to go to ground in London and wait for the invasion force to seize the city.
He tapped the map sharply.
It was never envisaged at the time the plan was drawn up that the British would be our allies, nor that we would be trying to put a friendly government into Westminster. The understanding was that they were our enemies, and their country would be ruled with an iron hand.
Karl nodded once. Britain had been, and still was, the Reich's most determined enemy, one protected by a body of water that might as well have been a castle moat. Hitler had shied away from trying to launch an offensive across the English Channel when the British had been at their weakest. In 1950, with American forces based in Britain, an invasion would have been a very chancy affair indeed. And then the British had developed their own nuclear weapons, and plans for a later invasion had been abandoned. Taking London would have been pointless if Berlin had been thrown into the fire.
Pretoria is a different case, Herr Reichsführer, Kortig said,
his finger tracing positions on the map.
Their government is scattered to reduce the risk of being decapitated by a suicide bomber, and we have been unable to obtain solid information on who is where at any one time. In addition, the South African troops protecting Pretoria are experienced battle-hardened veterans, men who are well used to coping with surprise attacks and driving back the attackers before they can do major damage.
Our stormtroopers are far better trained than black-ass terrorists, Karl said, icily.
It won't matter, Kortig said. At best, we may eliminate one or two senior government ministers, but I couldn't guarantee we would get them all. The South Africans would know we'd effectively declared war on them. These are not Italians, Herr Reichsführer. The South Africans will strike back at our own forces within their country. Our alliance with them will be at an end. The only people who will gain from the whole affair will be the blacks, who will no doubt sit back and watch as the whites destroy each other.
He shook his head.
South Africa is not a country that can be easily bullied, Herr Reichsführer, he said. Operation Headshot is a disaster waiting to happen.
Karl gritted his teeth. He'd asked for the truth, hadn't he? And Kortig was an experienced officer, with a string of successes to his name. If he believed the operation was impossible, he was probably right. And yet, the Reich needed to win in South Africa. They didn't dare lose.
It's unlikely the Reichstag will agree to commit additional troops to South Africa, he said grimly. Do we have any other way to achieve victory?
Probably not, Kortig said after a moment. Cutting off the supply lines from America would help, Herr Reichsführer, but the Yankees aren't the sole problem. The blacks know they're doomed if they surrender. Fighting is the only logical choice.
They're black, Karl protested.
So were the Ethiopians, Kortig reminded him. Just how badly did they manhandle the Italians?
Karl grimaced. Ethiopia had nearly defeated the Italian invasion in 1935, a humiliation that had badly weakened Mussolini's government. The British had liberated Ethiopia in 1941. Then, when Ethiopia had been returned to Italy by the terms of the peace treaty, left the Ethiopians with a considerable stockpile of weapons. It had taken the Italians 20 years to hammer Ethiopia into some semblance of order, and large parts of the country were still restless.
They still lost, he said finally.
And we may yet win in South Africa, Kortig said.
However, betraying our allies in the middle of a war will only lead to chaos.
Carl glowered. Is there anything else we can do?
Find a way to stiffen their spine, Kortik said. It isn't as if the apartheid government has anywhere to go.
I'll see what I can find, Carl said. Are you readying yourself to return to the war?
Yes, Herr Reichsführer, Kortik said.
However, I do have some concerns about the treatment of the wounded and the dead.
Carl cursed under his breath. South Africa had been meant to be a quick victory. The German troops would reinforce South Africa's, the blacks would be ruthlessly crushed, and there would be a victory parade through Berlin to show that the Reich still had teeth. Instead, thousands of soldiers were dead or wounded, and there was very little to show for it. For once, he was in total agreement with Hans Kruger. They didn't dare tell the Reich that so many fine young men had been killed or brutally maimed for nothing.
That isn't your concern, he said. Concentrate on finding ways to destroy the enemy.
Rumors are spreading, Herr Reichsführer, Kortig said. I've heard soldiers openly wondering just what's happening to the dead or wounded.
Such talk is to be reported at once, Carl snapped.
And then, working with the Heer will become impossible, Kortig said. We are not the Gestapo, Herr Reichsführer.
Carl scowled. The Gestapo had managed to wind up with egg on its face after von Braun had defected to the United States shortly after the Arab uprising had begun. His predecessor had been quick to take advantage of his rival's weakness by asserting control over counterintelligence and policing, which had led to another major turf war when the Gestapo had started to recover from its failure, and both services had often wound up working at cross purposes. God alone knew what the Americans had managed to do while the Gestapo and the SS had been at daggers drawn.
When I am Führer, there will be a reassessment, Carl thought coldly.
The Gestapo will be folded into the SS once the senior leadership has been purged.
I suppose not, he said neutrally. I'll see you before you depart, Herr Obergruppenführer.
Likewise, Herr Reichsführer, Kortig said.
Carl watched him go, thinking hard. Hans Kruger, damn the man, had made it clear that the civilians would never support deploying additional troops to South Africa. But the military might have other ideas. Field Marshal Justus Stoffregen was unlikely to take a stand, yet one of his immediate subordinates might be tempted into supporting the deployment in exchange for a number of concessions. It galled Carl to have to concede anything to the military. They should know to obey orders without question. But he had no choice. The military spent more time fighting turf wars with the Waffen-SS than it did preparing for the final war with America. He keyed his intercom.
Maria, please invite Field Marshal Voss to the castle, he said, slowly.
He made a habit of keeping track of Voss's schedule, along with those of the other high-ranking officials, and Voss shouldn't be too far away.
Let me know when he arrives.
Yes, Herr Reichsführer, Maria said.
There was a long pause as she put the request through the secure computer network.
Voss's aide says he can make it to the castle within 4 hours once he's finished his inspection tour.
That will be suitable, Carl assured her. Please let me know when he arrives.
He wondered, as he ordered dinner, if Voss was genuinely occupied or probing to see how important the matter was, but decided it wasn't worth trying to find out. Ordering Voss to the castle would make the field marshal dig in his heels. Field marshals didn't like being ordered around as though they were new recruits, and probably alert the civilians that Carl was trying to make a private arrangement with the military. Kruger, to give the bastard his due, had his own network of spies and agents within both the military and the SS. But he didn't understand, he couldn't understand, the triumph of the will. Our economy was poor when the Yankees blew up the global economy, Carl thought.
He hadn't lived through those times, but his parents had. No wonder they'd wanted a farm, even if it exposed them to constant insurgent attacks. They'd wanted something solid under their feet. And we still managed to create an empire greater than Alexander's. It was nearly 5 hours before Field Marshal Gunter Voss was shown into the office. Carl rose to his feet, carefully pasting a civil expression on his face. The military, for all its skill and dedication, wasn't as devoted to the will as the SS, but it had to be respected for the moment. Afterwards, when Carl held supreme power, it would be different. The military would be folded into the SS, and its senior leadership removed from power. It might have been 40 years since Rommel had allowed the Jews to escape Palestine, but the SS had never forgotten, let alone forgiven. Pity Rommel died before the Führer, he thought, as he shook hands with Voss. Himmler would have given him a thoroughly unpleasant death.
Herr Reichsführer, Voss said, once they had exchanged pleasantries, I confess, I was quite curious to see the castle. I've heard so much about it.
I'm afraid we don't sacrifice virgins here, Carl said. He smiled, as if to say that all such rumors were thoroughly absurd. Nor do we bleed our men white so they are bound to us in death as well as life.
How disappointing, Voss said.
He sat on a chair and leaned forward.
I'm due to inspect the fortifications at Dunkirk tomorrow, Herr Reichsführer, so I really don't have much time. Can we get to the point?
Of course, Carl said. He disliked small talk, too. Thankfully, it wasn't one of the qualifications for his post. I want your support for deploying additional forces to South Africa.
Chancy, Voss observed. The logistics are going to be a pain in the ass. Any day now, the Yankees are going to start sending more advanced MANPAD weapons to South Africa, weapons capable of hitting our transport aircraft in flight. And once we start losing those aircraft in significant numbers, well, we might as well admit the war is on the verge of being lost along with them.
The Luftwaffe will certainly be horrified at the thought of having the paint on their aircraft scratched, Carl agreed tightly.
Scratched isn't the problem, Voss said simply. The problem is losing aircraft we cannot easily replace, and the road network from French North Africa to South Africa is pathetic.
Carl nodded slowly. Millions of coolies had been pressed into working on a road and rail network to link the disparate sections of Africa together, but it was slow going. The blacks were rebellious, and the French, he suspected, were deliberately delaying, fearing, perhaps, that they would lose the last vestiges of their independence once the road network was up and running. Besides, the South Africans had already lost hundreds of vehicles to IED attacks on their roads. The problem would merely spread through the rest of Africa. Voss smiled, rather coldly.
What are you prepared to offer in exchange?
You're engaged in a long duel with the Luftwaffe over who controls the close air support aircraft, Carl said.
It wasn't a problem the SS faced, not when the Waffen SS had its own fleet of CAS aircraft.
I would be prepared to throw my support behind you.
He watched Voss carefully, wondering just what the field marshal was thinking. The Heer wanted its own CAS fleet desperately, knowing that the Luftwaffe preferred to spend money on heavy bombers and fancy jet fighters rather than aircraft that might actually be useful in South Africa. And yet, Goring's will still cast a long shadow over the service he'd built up from scratch. It had taken years of political infighting for the Kriegsmarine to get control over the aircraft it flew from its aircraft carriers. Not in the end that the carriers ended up going very far from the Reich, he thought. There was nowhere for them to go, unless they wanted to run the gauntlet of British and American missiles. After what had happened to Norway, few countries would cheerfully accept a German ship paying a port call. Sending the fleet to South Africa would be asking for trouble. He frowned at the thought. Might the Navy actually do something useful and ship troops south? The rebels couldn't harm the fleet, and the Americans were unlikely to start a war by attacking German ships. unless they thought they could win. Karl knew he would have started the war in an instant if he thought he could win outright, and he assumed the Americans had the same attitude. What else could explain the steady pressure they kept on the Reich?
"That's a very tempting offer, Herr Reichsführer," Voss said finally. "Of course, this may put the Luftwaffe in the opposite camp."
"Which would put the Kriegsmarine in ours," Karl observed.
"The Navy would hardly be likely to concede anything to the Luftwaffe. Give the flyboys an inch, and they would take a mile.
We can hold them at bay."
"Let us hope so, Herr Reichsführer," Voss said. "But the logistics are still a major headache."
"We can ship troops south," Karl said, and explained his reasoning. "The rebels will find it harder to interrupt those supply lines."
Chapter 9. Albert Speer University, Berlin. 23 July, 1985.
"I checked with a number of people I know," Gudrun said, once the room was locked and the bug was listening to bad American music. "Conrad's father is still unaware that his son is anywhere other than South Africa, while four other families have not heard anything from their children, even censored letters, for the last couple of months. Three of their children had a habit of writing at least once a week, before suddenly going silent."
She took a breath. The fourth, she'd had to screw up all her courage to visit, for she'd known the father by reputation, and nothing she'd heard had been good. His wife had left him shortly after the children had reached adulthood, which proved he'd treated her badly. The Reich wouldn't look too kindly on a wife who abandoned her husband, denying her both a divorce and the right to remarry. 2 minutes of standing on his doorstep, feeling his eyes leaving trails of slime across her breasts, had convinced her that the bastard's son had every reason not to write to his father. There was no way to know if he was dead or alive. "I should have taken Kurt," she thought, "although that would have been far too revealing. He would have asked too many questions."
"That's what I found, anyway," she said. "What about the rest of you?"
"I checked with my maternal auntie," Sven said. "She told me that her eldest son has gone silent, too, although his letters are always irregular. My paternal grandfather, however, said he'd received a heavily censored letter from his middle son only last week. It wasn't very detailed, but it was something."
Gudrun listened, quietly, as the remaining students offered their own observations. If they'd had doubts, she realized, they'd lost them. Too many of their military relatives had gone silent at once. Even the ones who rarely wrote home had gone completely silent. It chilled her to the bone when she considered the implications. Statistically, for a group of 8 students to know over 30 soldiers who'd stopped writing to their families, the casualty rates had to be terrifyingly high.
"I came across something else," Horst said, once everyone else had finished. "My second cousin is married to a soldier on deployment. She got a letter from him asking after a friend who'd been wounded and sent home. So she checked with the guy's wife. She knew the lady personally, and the wife didn't know anything about it. The poor woman went to ask questions, and then... nothing."
Gudrun blinked. "Nothing at all?"
"Nothing," Horst confirmed. "Someone told her to keep her mouth shut, or else."
Hilda leaned forward, her face pale.
"How can you be sure?"
"I can't think of any other explanation," Horst said. "They could have easily told her that her husband was fine, if he was fine. But they were clearly unwilling to admit he was wounded."
He looked at Gudrun.
"You might want to ask the person who helped you sneak into the hospital just how many other soldiers are held there," he added. "I'd bet good money that there are more wounded distributed around the Reich."
"I wouldn't take that bet," Sven said.
"Me neither," Gudrun said.
She looked from face to face, bracing herself. They had already crossed the line, but it wasn't too late.
"We know the government is lying to us, that it has lied to us many times before,
What do we do about it?
What can we do? Hilda asked.
If we start asking questions, we will get kicked out of the university.
Gudrun nodded. The one topic that was off limits at the university was the Reich itself. A few students had questioned that back in the early days and been unceremoniously expelled. Hell, they weren't encouraged to study more than the STEM subjects. Any student who showed more than minimal interest in the social sciences was likely to run into trouble.
Then we can't ask questions here, she said.
She'd been thinking about it ever since she discovered what had happened to Conrad.
We need to spread the word.
We could send messages through the computer network, Sven offered. People like me have been sending covert messages without the SS reading them ever since the network was established.
Or they just don't care, Horst pointed out darkly. What are you actually doing online, anyway?
Sven colored. Could you send a message without it being trapped in the filters and read? Horst looked back at him.
Could you send a message without it being traced back to you?
Easily, Sven said. You just wipe the record of it being sent from the network. It looks as though the message spontaneously appeared in the recipient's inbox.
Gudrun held up a hand. Yes, but we need to reach as many people as possible, she said, carefully. How many people do you know who have access to a computer?
There was an awkward pause.
Very few, outside the university network, Sven conceded finally.
That's true, Gudrun said. I don't have a computer at home. Is there anyone in this room who does have a private computer?
No, Mikhail Sachs said. My father would explode if I suggested spending 10,000 Reichmarks on an American computer.
Gudrun nodded. Her father would have pretty much the same reaction. It would cost much of his yearly salary, assuming he could purchase one in the first place. And, once he had it, it wouldn't be much use. Gudrun had a typewriter she shared with her younger brothers, and that had been quite expensive enough. Buying a printer would cost another 5,000 Reichmarks, and linking it up to the national computer network would be impossible. The Reich wouldn't want to put such a powerful communications tool in everyone's hands.
So, what do we do? Hilda asked.
One hand toyed with her hair as she spoke.
We cannot risk adding more people to our group, can we?
Gudrun shook her head. There would be spies within the university. SS, Gestapo, Abwehr. And the more people she recruited, the greater the chance of accidentally bringing a traitor into the group and being betrayed. Guarding one's mouth was hard enough when one wasn't doing something the state would consider treacherous. Hell, the rowdier students might easily be the spies. They hadn't been kicked out despite skimping on their lessons.
We can send a message through the computer network to every student in the university, Sven said. I can make it look as though it came from outside the building. Hell, there are other campuses in other cities.
Yes, but they'll stamp down hard, Horst warned.
They'd have to stamp on all of us, Sven said.
That's one idea, Gudrun said, but I have another.
She braced herself.
Do you recall distributing leaflets when you were in the Hitler Youth?
I never had to distribute leaflets, Sven said after a moment. Is that something you had to do?
Yeah, Hilda said. While you boys were going camping and playing with weapons, we used to hand out papers exhorting greater efforts for the fatherland and other such pieces of crap.
It wasn't all wine and roses, Sven objected. They used to make us run for miles and chased us with whips.
Poor dear, Hilda said. At least you got to be away from home for a couple of weeks every year.
Gudrun winced in memory. The Bund Deutscher Mädel, the female wing of the Hitler Youth, hadn't been fun. Maybe it had had its moments. She'd always enjoyed playing sports, and she'd been healthy enough to avoid the public humiliations meted out to overweight girls. But she hadn't enjoyed it. Walking around in ugly uniforms and handing out leaflets to passersby had been annoying. Even at the time, she doubted that many of the recipients did anything other than use the leaflets to start fires.
The point is that we can print out leaflets of our own, she said. Wearing our old uniforms, we can then
walk through the streets and hand them out.
The police will notice, Sven objected.